Maybe you could start by giving a relatively brief, if that's possible, overview of what the Affordable Care Act really does, maybe how it matters to the students here, and then some of the biggest myths or sort of most extreme distortions of what the Affordable Care Act actually is.
Sure. Giant question. I mean, literally a question that I've been asked since 2008. So when Obama was elected, and as part of his core platform, he talked about reforming the healthcare system, which was an idea that goes all the way back to, obviously, the Clinton administration and Hillary Clinton. The minute he took the White House, this issue just got, just lit up across the country. So at this point in time, I'm working with health systems, medical groups, hospitals, and it really didn't matter what topic I was coming in to talk about. It was always, okay, how does this link up with healthcare reform? And that was the huge focus. My point of view is healthcare reform really comes down to a couple of basic core issues. One is, how do you deal with the fact that the cost of healthcare is out of control? So the cost of healthcare in the United States, in terms of maintaining a model for delivery of health assets, is unsustainable. So what we're looking at right now is between now and about 2020, the average cost per person on what the U.S. spends on healthcare is going to double. Now, if you look at some just basic statistics and you say, okay, what does the U.S. spend per capita on its population for healthcare versus others, we outspend everyone else in the Western world on healthcare. Now, knee-jerk is, well, wait a second, we're America. And we're a highly industrialized nation. We have so much innovation going on. If we are spending more, but we're spending more on things like cool innovations in surgery, new techniques for treating cancer, transplants to prolong life, then this could actually work out well for the population. This is the big catch. We're spending more than the next 12 industrialized nations in the world, yet our clinical outcomes, so how well we deliver medicine, doesn't even rank in some categories in the top 20. Life expectancy for an American is less than, for example, a Canadian, less than a Brit. Your chances of basically surviving with cancer, heart disease, and other chronic illnesses are lower than someone in the Netherlands or Germany. So this is a huge disconnect for Americans. If we're spending more money than anyone else, why don't we have better healthcare? Why don't we have better life expectancy? And so this kicked off this huge debate because Medicare, as you guys know, which is the entitlement program for anyone over the age of 65 who's a U.S. citizen, is basically set to explode as the baby boomer generation hits 65 and starts jumping into the program. So this program was set up all the way back under Lyndon Johnson, okay? So we're talking back in the 60s now. And what's interesting is when Johnson set this up, so you talk about polarization of a topic for decades, he set the program up and linked it to, of all things, increasing civil rights for African Americans. So from day one, when the United States entered into a national healthcare program, it became a polarizing topic. So Johnson, when he rolled out Medicare, actually turned around and said to be able to actually get federal government resources for Medicare, it had to be linked to desegregation. So if you think about it, right away, you're going to throw a pretty big divide into the United States on people's perception of government involvement in healthcare. And then literally over decades, that rhetoric has just ratcheted up. So it all started really with a discussion on Medicare as the source of U.S. healthcare entitlement program is unsustainable. The demographics and the number of people accessing the program means we don't have enough money to continue this really past about anywhere from 2016 to 2026. So your parents are out of luck. Medicare will not exist for you. Now, what do we do about that? So that's question number one. Question number two is, we spend more than any other country on healthcare, yet not everyone has access to healthcare coverage. So a big misconception in the US is, if you get sick, you will be treated. Well, that depends with what you get sick with. Any American can walk into an emergency room and get access to healthcare, even if you can't pay your bill. However, if you want to go see a doctor, if you want to go see a dentist, if you want to go see a psychologist, if you don't have a highly acute or severe condition, you will be denied if you don't have access to pay. Right now, there's 56 million Americans who have no health care insurance in this country. So the second area that healthcare reform dove into was, what do we do about 56 million people in the richest nation in the world not having access to healthcare? And is that really a luxury item or a basic human right? The third item came down to really attacking the quality in the system. The US's approach to delivering healthcare is very much based on brick and mortar hospitals. So if you think about Lincoln, Nebraska, it's based on St. Elizabeth Hospital and Bryan LGH. What's interesting, in other parts of the world, healthcare is delivered primarily through doctor's offices, clinics, home health agencies, long-term care agencies. It actually, these other systems are really looking at how do we keep you from going into the hospital to begin with, preventative health. Once you're sick, let's get you out of the hospital as quickly as possible. Why? Hospitals are dangerous and they're expensive. So the other major area that the Affordable Care Act looked to tackle is, could we develop new models to improve the quality of healthcare in hospitals, but also doctor's offices and other places? And could we change how people are paid for giving healthcare? Because in the US, you're, as a doctor, paid regardless of whether your patients get better or not. You're simply paid for what you do. So that's an interesting dichotomy to all of the other economic systems in the US, where obviously you have the concept of supply and demand. And if you develop, if you offer a high quality service, the higher the quality of your service, normally the more you can charge for the service. In the US, it's on its head in healthcare. It's actually the law of demand and supply. The more that you build hospitals, the more the community uses the hospitals. And so there's actually models where they've looked at the number of x-rays and CT scans, CAT scans, and MRIs in a given zip code, and tracked over the course of the years, as the number of machines were built and increased year over year, the number of imaging that was done increased year over year, even though the population's health never changed. So if you build it, they will come. And why? Because if you build it, you can bill for it. And it doesn't matter if it's needed, and it doesn't matter if it helps the patient. The US system is based on, if you give healthcare, you can bill for healthcare. And so one of the other major principles of the Affordable Care Act was, we need to change that model. That's ridiculous. It has to be, if you deliver good healthcare and your patients get better, you get paid more. And if you deliver poor healthcare, or you create waste in the system by running the bills up, we're going to pay you less. So those were some of the core foundations that went into healthcare reform. Now, obviously, you take a look at that and you're thinking, well, why did everyone get so fired up, right? Because, I mean, these are some pretty basic principles of looking at a system and saying, we have flaws in the system, let's identify waste, let's figure out how we can be more efficient, and let's just push this out. Unfortunately, the Affordable Care Act was about 2,400 pages, and if you start reading through that, you find lots of little idiosyncrasies and statements that were seized upon to really get some fiery rhetoric going, to say, you know what, at the end of the day, the law in itself may make sense, but the problem is who put the law forward. And the law was put forward by a democratically elected president from the Democratic Party, who was saying, I'm going to make this really a big standpoint for my administration. So that set a collision course with the Republicans on saying, well, we're going to have to throw out literally the baby with the bathwater. And so they were able to nitpick on some pretty cool topics in there to get some good rhetoric going.
So probably the biggest of those would have been the death panels.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that and maybe identify two or three sort of myths about the Affordable Care Act that were picked on, but that really when you started looking into it, it's really just people trying to get political attention for an issue rather than make a real substantive point.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, right now, if let's say you're elderly and you want to go and you want to meet your family physician and you want to have a conversation about, hey, I've just got diagnosed with Alzheimer's or I've been diagnosed with cancer and I want to have a conversation about really how I want to live my life going forward. Or even actually if you're healthy. So if you're a healthy aged adult and you wanted to go and have a conversation about what type of healthcare resources you wanted to access in your later years, what's interesting is in the American model, your doctor's only able to bill for something that has a code. So you actually can't sit down and just have a casual conversation with your physician unless your physician can figure out how to align this to a billing code. Now, what's interesting is I made the comment, a lot of healthcare in the United States is focused on hospital-based care. Well, one of the reasons why other countries have been able to depreciate cost is they try to let our elderly live out the end of their life in their homes. So one of the worst places you can imagine to die is as an end-stage cancer patient in an ICU at Bryan LGH with tubes coming out of you, heavily sedated. Your family can barely kind of get in and out around you because you have so many machines around. And what's interesting is, you guys ever heard of a hockey, it's called a hockey stick curve. That's actually not a Canadian made-up term. Okay, but basically if you look at a graph and you see a very flat line and then a sudden dip up, that's basically how healthcare spending looks in the United States by age of population. So you basically have a very low, steady expense in healthcare until the last 20% of your life, and then you start firing up. So really, between the ages of 65 and 70, the curve starts to take a tip. And what's interesting is your last months of life can generate six figures of healthcare expense. Well, why is that? Because you're spending your last months of life doing aggressive therapies that really have no clinical basis in saving you, but it's about, hey, we're gonna fight this to the end. So the idea was, hey, you know what? Why don't we allow our patients to have a conversation about how they wanna end their years, but allow then the physicians to bill for it. So within the healthcare law, there was this discussion around, you know, end of life care. And if a patient brought this up or a physician brought this up proactively to healthy patients and said, I want you to start thinking about, you know, your personal preferences over life. This had nothing to do with euthanasia, by the way. It had nothing to do with ending life, but it was, what kind of things do I want done, you know, in my later years? That got seized upon and linked with another concept, which was peer-reviewed boards that would look at different scientific methodologies for treating patients and say these boards were basically tasked to look at research as research was coming out and say, what does evidence-based best practice say is the best way to treat, you know, a patient with heart failure or a patient with cancer. These two things began to get molded together to, we're going to have death panels. So what we're going to have is faceless bureaucrats who have no clinical background, but who are riding a political agenda that's focused on decreasing waste in the healthcare system, making decisions on who gets care in the last years of their life. And the idea was, if you basically went to your doctor and you were 75 years of age, and the doctor consulted the bureaucratic panel and said, at 75, statistically, you're really not a really big contributing member of society anymore, we could cease giving you all care. So we would literally cut your Medicare benefits and say you no longer had access to any healthcare. If you got sick, we wouldn't treat you. If you needed a hip transplant, you were denied. It was, you are no longer useful, you're gonna die, so that we can cut costs. That was the concept of death panels. Nowhere in there did that ever exist. And what's interesting was, it all started with an op-ed piece, I believe in the New York Times, that Sarah Palin seized upon. When Sarah Palin seized upon it, it then got picked up by Limbaugh and O'Reilly on Fox, and it went viral. And it was crazy. What's interesting is the actual concept of counseling elderly people on how they want to end their years is a basic concept in other Western countries. They had to pull it out of the healthcare reform law. And even after they pulled it out of the law, it was still on banners and signs right up into the Supreme Court decision saying that the law could stand. People still believe it's there. 30% of Medicare recipients still believe that death panels exist. The AARP, which is basically Association for the Aged in the United States, did a study as of, I think it was beginning of 2012. It said 30% of the population still believed, of their members, so over the age of 60, still believe that death panels existed. 25% were unsure. So that's over half of our elderly still think there's a touch and go moment of them maybe getting, you know, put out on an ice floe.
I think one of the most memorable moments for me during that whole debate, Sarah Palin snagged this vision of the death panels from some kind of obscure right-wing blogger who Jon Stewart had on The Daily Show. And they're talking all nice for a little while, and then Jon Stewart pulls out the Affordable Care Act, all 2,400 pages of it, and plops it down in front of her and says, and so where are the death panels in here? Can you just show me the page that it's on? And she, I mean, it's a hilarious clip. You've got to watch it, because she's like, it's in, I don't know, it's in here. Like, what? This is what you have made your career off of. Wouldn't you know, like, what page number, like, about where in the bill it was? She made a big show about, like, oh, it's in here somewhere. I can't remember. And Jon Stewart just looked at her. So there's one example of how kind of it was a big, became a big political football. Could you sort of situate the, like one of the big prongs of the ACA is the notion of these health exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about that a little bit and maybe situate it with other options that we could have taken for health insurance reform? Part of the question is the Affordable Care Act an extreme or a moderate solution to the healthcare crisis that you were talking about in terms of costs and coverage? Where would you put it on the spectrum of sort of more radical, the moderate to radical solutions?
So interestingly enough, I mean, when the debate kicked off, there was an organization in the United States called the Kaiser Family Foundation. So you can check these guys out at kff.org. They basically track all of the political dialogue around healthcare reform and anything that's healthcare related. And so at one point what they had was literally, it was a matrix. Here is every single politician or by party who has weighed in on a healthcare reform option and literally started segmenting it down to how are they going to cut costs, how are they going to expand coverage, how are they going to improve quality, all the way through like every clinical issue you could imagine. And at one point, I remember going online around it's been November, December 2009. I couldn't print the matrix on a page. I mean, there were just so many options out there, individual senators kicking it out, committees kicking it up. Obviously, you had the Republican Party, the Democratic Party. You know, Reid had his option. What was interesting is at the end of the day, the Affordable Care Act was actually a compromise that really did not hit the nail on the head for anybody. Yet it's seen as this radical left-wing piece of legislation. The original Obama mandate was to have universal single-payer coverage. So he looked at that as an option, saying, you know what, we're going to maintain private healthcare insurance companies. However, federal government is going to create this super plan to cover those that have no insurance. That was politically toxic. He could not get support. I mean, Democrats were even thinking, like, you know, Dixiecrats especially, I put my name on this. I mean, I have no hope of getting reelected. And so one of the ideas that came out of this was this idea of the exchange. So the exchange was kind of the, I would say, go-between answer to, we need to expand coverage for this 56 million American population that has no coverage. We have to make sure that we're not trampling on states' rights. But at the same point in time, if I have a Republican state that swears to inaction, there has to be a federal fallback. So one of the big problems with the 56 million Americans who have no coverage is we all pay for them. Now, this is an interesting concept. And so I get asked a lot, you know, as a Canadian, you must support free healthcare. And I laugh. Nothing is free. You know, name one thing in this country that you get for free. I mean, if you're here, for example, you're going to University of Nebraska and you're on a bursary, it's not free. Someone donated money to UNL's foundation to cover you, right? So the concept of free healthcare doesn't exist. The concept also of letting people not have coverage, and that's not our responsibility, doesn't exist. Because here's what happens. If one of these 56 million Americans walks into an emergency room, and by law, every hospital in America that has a Medicare ID number, okay, that gets Medicare patients in it, has to have an emergency room. And by law, they are not allowed to deny care to anybody based on nationality, citizenship, creed, or right to pay. So what does that mean? It means if you're hit by a car and you're brought in on an ambulance or you crawl up the ramp of the emergency room, the first thing out of their mouths cannot be, I'm sorry, can you show me your credit card, please? Now, it could be the third thing, right? But what they have to do is they immediately have to assess, is this person in high need of medical care? And the first and most important thing is save this person's life. At some point while you're there, yeah, I'm pretty stoked. As a Canadian, I have three in me already. The other idea was rationing. And so setting lifetime limits on what you could access for healthcare. Basically, the idea was, if the government gets into medicine, we're going to turn around and we're going to start making decisions on members of the population to say, you know what, from an aggregate statistical standpoint, you don't deserve to live anymore. You don't deserve to have access to limited resources. I encourage you guys, if you haven't seen that John Stewart debate, there's a comedian out of Canada called Rick Mercer. Rick Mercer did this great segment called Talking to Americans. And he would go into major American cities and he actually did a great segment in New York City. He went onto Columbia University's campus, and he would interview professors and students about issues. And the issue would be like, are you willing to sign this petition and then read the petition to the camera? And you had a porter from Columbia University who turned around and said, Canada, please stop putting your elderly on ice floes as a way to like control Medicare costs. This is someone who works at Columbia University, okay? They would, and it's funny, this was the fear. If you have government involved in medicine, government is killing people on an ongoing basis. One of the great rebuttals on the idea of rationing was the belief that in the UK and Britain, there's basically a program that encourages people to commit suicide to reduce costs, and that a third of all deaths in UK hospitals by the elderly are elderly being over-medicated with pain medication so they can die to reduce the cost for everyone else. I mean, this is some of the concepts that were going on around. Taking my doctor away, the idea that you couldn't choose your doctor anymore, you had the elimination of choice, which obviously is a huge fear in American society. You can't tell me what to do. That would never happen. I mean, again, you could go to an exchange with the government, you know, support a physician, but you would never have to leave your current physician either. And good chances your current physician will probably want to have their practice included within the exchange. Healthcare for all. Interestingly enough, when the ACA was passed, 30 million Americans were still left without coverage. So we think of this radical program of redistributing wealth and giving healthcare access to everybody, yet out of 56 million, only 26 million got coverage. And then when the Supreme Court actually struck down the increase in Medicaid, so part of that law was the states had to expand Medicaid to the 133% of poverty level, and the Supreme Court said you cannot do that. You can't force a state to increase their Medicaid coverage. Why? Because states are going bankrupt right now with their current population covering Medicaid. Well, that just pulled it down even more. So the original law was to cover an additional 30 million lives. That's actually been reduced. I think the estimates are about 18 to 20 million if this thing stands today. And, well, depending what happens tonight. what else? Oh, and my personal favorite was every little old lady or little old man with a sign that said, keep the government off my Medicare. Yeah. Okay, let's think about that for a second. So healthcare reform was passed March 2010. January 30th, 2010, the single largest purchaser of healthcare in the United States was the federal government. Medicare, they transfer money to the states for Medicaid, DOD, so our active military, VA, the US Postal Service. Plus Congress, Senate, and everyone who works as part of the federal government is part of that. They were the single largest purchaser of healthcare. April 1, 2010, healthcare reform is passed. Who becomes the single largest purchaser of healthcare? Federal government. Nothing changed. But it was interesting, and I mean, I've even seen that in some of the attack ads that were being run. Still, this focus of get the government out of healthcare. The government has been in healthcare since the Johnson administration. And actually, if you go all the way back to FDR and the New Deal, they started putting toes in the water there. So the government's been in healthcare for longer than any of us have been alive. It's just that it sounds really good to turn around and make that a popular issue. So those were some of the fun little hot button ones. I actually think the ID chips are cooler than death panels.
more minority report-ish.
Exactly.
Well, maybe real briefly, and then we can get to some student questions and then let you go watch election results. So, I mean, one of the big bugaboos was we're going to end up like Canada. We're going to have this, you know, government-run health insurance program. Now, I don't want to put you on the spot in terms of speaking for all Canadians, and certainly there are divergent views on it. But I'm kind of curious to know sort of like what are Canadian attitudes towards their healthcare system? Was it as much of a, you know, scary thing as it was painted by some people? And, you know, what were some Canadian reactions to the political debate about the ACA in our country?
That's a good question. So, I think the first thing to realize is that the Canadian system didn't just pop up one day as a national system. It actually started in Saskatchewan, okay? Which is basically, Saskatchewan is kind of like our version of Nebraska, all right? It's the plains. So it is an agrarian state. It's conservative for the most part. But what you had was you had a local premier or governor, Tommy Douglas, who had a very negative experience as a young man where he got very sick, and a person in the community basically bailed out his family to allow him to get treatment. And he thought, you know, this is ridiculous. You know, we're Canada. You know, we just walked out of World War II. You know, we were part of the Allies. You know, we've seen our economy resurge. We're growing as a nation. And how ridiculous is it in a Western nation that, you know, my parents, had they not had charity, would not have been able to give me the life that I wanted. So he goes into political office, and then he makes one of his crusades, this idea of having universal coverage in Saskatchewan. So it starts out as a local idea. It was radical. Most Canadians nationally did not support it. But it took hold in Saskatchewan, and slowly but surely other provinces turned around and said, you know what, this makes sense. Okay? And this comes down to, you know, you go back into Canadian history, you know, what's the concept in the psyche of a Canadian? Is it individual rights versus, you know, groupthink? You know, and we're really, as a country, we're a quilt. I mean, we were founded as a quilt. Started with French and English. We had a lot of expansion from immigration. And everyone basically holds to this identity of Canadian with regionalization. But I think the big difference between us and the U.S. is when push comes to shove, people are willing to subordinate individual rights for the good of the group. That is a huge cultural difference, and it goes all the way back to, you know, how were you guys founded? You guys were founded by people who were avoiding religious persecution, who came in and said, I need to have the freedom to do what I want to do, right? And then push back on the British to say, you can't tell me what to do from afar. And then throw in a little bit of religious fervor on, well, I can tell that I'm in the good grace of God because I'm wealthy, and you're not in the good grace of God because you're poor. You start having an interesting little cultural mix to fast forward a couple hundred years and talk about access to healthcare. So when the Canadian system ended up taking hold and went national, we really looked at it as everyone's got a pitch in. So the way the Canadian healthcare system works is we all pay federal taxes. A percentage of your federal taxes goes into a pot, actually called Medicare. So it's a similar name, but it's for everybody. It's cradle to grave. And what happens is this pot of money gets redistributed based on the population, which means that the more rich provinces, like Alberta, our version of Texas, with all the nuances that includes, turns around, and because it is the richest province in Canada, its tax revenue is redistributed to poor provinces, like the Maritimes, our version of Maine, okay? Fishermen. And that's okay. Canadians do not have a problem with that. Then you pay your provincial tax or your state tax, and a pocket of that goes into the provincial fund. So you get federal transfer payments and provincial payments. Now here's what's interesting. The Canadian government has set up basically within the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and I believe it's the Canadian Medicare Act, here is what needs to exist in every province. How you run it is up to you. So what's interesting is if you look at all the provinces and territories in Canada, you find completely different distribution systems. So we look at the federal government's role in healthcare really as the redistribution of money to ensure that our poorest are being taken care of along with our richest, but it's really a local thing because every province has the right to distribute the healthcare resources as they see fit in the model they see fit as long as they hit a certain target level of quality and coverage and distribution. So when the Americans started arguing about coverage and exchanges and states' rights and pointed up north and said, if we go down this route, you know, look how bad things are going to be, we all kind of laughed because we score higher on clinical outcomes. We're spending about half of what you guys are. And we have a model that allows for technically state rights, or what we call provincial rights and freedoms, to distribute the system as we see fit. So now, is that system sustainable? No. We suffer from the exact same affliction you do, which is a very big baby boomer population getting old. When people get old, they get sick, and when they get sick, they tap the healthcare system. And a very small population of Gen X, Gen Y, and Millennium, whose tax dollars will not be able to fund that bigger group at some point in time. The biggest issue that we have actually is access. So hot button issue that got played off on Fox News, CNN during the healthcare reform debate, wait times. Canadians are dying from cancer every year because it takes them, you know, 36 months to get a mammogram. Or it takes you 3 months to have a tumor checked and excised. It doesn't exist. There was actually an interesting case where a Canadian from Kingston, Ontario, was put on attack ads for healthcare reform and basically said that she had had a tumor. She had to wait so long. She almost died. She had to go to the U.S. She had to go to the U.S. for treatment, yada, 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 yada. And she was basically, she was the poster child for, if we go universal, we will kill our population. Well, what was interesting is the federal government of Canada took a very big interest in this woman's case. And technically, where the federal government can't access healthcare records, they basically said, well, here's where this lady lives, and contacted the Ministry of Health from that province. And that ministry said, well, technically, that would be a breach in our quality. So they did an analysis. And what they found was this woman was absolutely full of crap. But it made a great story. So at the end of the day, if you, for example, are a weekend warrior, so I'm in my mid to late 30s now, and I tweak my knee playing flag football, and it hurts, and I go to the doctor, and the doctor says, you know what, you've blown out your knee, you're probably going to have surgery coming up, but this doesn't affect my quality of life, I can still work, my pain is manageable. Guess what, I may wait a year to have my knee done. Why? Because there's someone older than me who blew out their knee, who can't move, who's on a pain scale from 0 to 10 at 9, who has no quality of life anymore, that person gets to go to the head of line. That's really the difference in the system. Where we're going, though, as a country, is we even realize that if you have wealthy Canadians who are willing to pay and leave the public system, that opens the door to advanced people who can't pay. You need to start experimenting with two-tier systems. The question comes, can you do that without affecting quality? So your best doctors all run into the private system, and then your public doctors are Doogie Howser, and they don't know what they're doing. Can you create a balance? So we look at what's going on empathetically south. We don't suffer from the same problems, but if we fast forward Canada 10 to 15 years, we know that the access issue is going to become crucial.
Do you have a little more time for maybe
a couple
of questions here? There's, I mean, a lot of stuff here, and so maybe Ben, you can start us off.
You said that the U.S. healthcare doesn't do nearly as good as other developed countries. I was wondering how much of that comes down to like different lifestyle choices the U.S. makes, such as the fact that the U.S. tends to be more obese than other countries. And how much of it is like that our healthcare is bad, and how much of it is that we live not intelligently at the time?
That's a great question. I'll give you a good example of that. I mean, when you turn around and you're looking at, for example, life expectancy, I mean, you're talking about the difference between, like, let's say, 71 and 74. You know, I mean, in terms of the differences are small, if you think about it in a total sense. But what is interesting is a lot of the problems, for example, that Americans suffer, Canadians suffer them too. So again, I mean, working in the U.S. healthcare system for 8 years, I literally look at it as, a future window to what my family and friends up in Canada will be experiencing. So rates of obesity aren't as high, rates of childhood obesity aren't as high, rates of asthma amongst children not as high, but they are catching up. Yet there's definitely a factor in that. I mean, and the way that I would look at it is it's American society willingness not to promote potentially bad lifestyle choices, but to not inhibit them. So one of the big debates that came down during healthcare reform was the idea of syntax. Okay, so we know that America's rate of obesity is out of control. Type 2 diabetes in children under the age of 18 is higher than it's ever been in record. And if you're a young person and you have type 2 diabetes, which is normally adult onset, and is driven by weight gain, you're basically, your pancreas can no longer handle, or sorry, is it pancreas? Great, now I'm blanking on healthcare terms. Pancreas, cheers. Your pancreas isn't able to handle and regulate your insulin production. You don't get rid of that. Once you have that, that is a lifetime disease. So the fact that we know, for example, the high, I dare say this in Nebraska, high fructose corn syrup, right, being added to everything, because the sugar content of the food that we serve children, and my tongue-in-cheek comment, for example, that the USDA allows ketchup, a packet of ketchup, to be considered a vegetable serving, because, and French fries are a vegetable serving because of lobby groups from states. You know what? We've allowed economics and politics to really determine the future of our healthcare system in the decisions we make. One of the things Obama's administration thought of is, what if you could fund healthcare reform by slapping taxes on things like fruit juice with high fructose corn syrup or Mountain Dew? In Canada, if I want to buy a pack of smokes, I'm paying about $18 a pack. That is principally taxation that goes right into our Medicare fund. Makes sense, right? If people are going to make lifestyle choices that ultimately tee them right into the healthcare system, and they may go in public or private, put your money where your wealth, where your mouth is. You want to live free or die? Own it up all your life. You know, and another interesting discussion I've had with some hospitals in New Hampshire. New Hampshire, for example, has no helmet law, so you can drive a motorcycle without a helmet, right? Because it's an individual right and freedom. Do you know what they call people on motorcycles in New Hampshire who don't wear helmets? Organ donors. Now, that would be, to be blunt, the best outcome. The worst outcome for that individual, however, is they're now brain dead. They have no function in their higher brain, but they're being kept alive. And they can stay on that way for a long time. Why should that person's healthcare be covered 100% by taxpayers when they made the decision to do that? Where's the individual responsibility? Can we not go after that person's estate and say, you made the decision to not be safe, pony up? Seatbelt laws, smoking. Insurance companies in America do this right now. It's the idea of pre-existing conditions. Okay. Now, in pre-healthcare reform, this got really scary, because if you got cancer, your healthcare insurance company could kick you out, find a loophole, kick you out of your renewal, and say, I don't want to cover you anymore. Now, the idea was, I don't want to cover you because I don't have to pay for your cancer. You're a great investment when you're healthy. When you get sick, I have to pay out. I'm not making profit anymore. I'm going to kick you out. Healthcare reform changed that and said, no, you can't kick people out for when they get sick. You also cannot deny coverage for a pre-existing condition. So someone who has diabetes is allowed to have health care insurance in the country. The question is, did you get diabetes because you're type 1, you were born that way, or did you get diabetes because you're morbidly obese? Where's the personal responsibility? So I think, you know, in terms of the questions on health care reform and lifestyle, the lifestyle of an American is not that significantly different. Like, what happens, though, is the government is very hands-off on taking a role in stopping you from doing that.
You mentioned pre-existing conditions, so basically saying that they have to take you, but is there any regulation on what, like, can they jack up the price as high as they want then because you have a pre-existing condition?
It's a good question.
Make a profit.
A private healthcare insurance company does not have to take you right now. It's one of the reasons why the exchanges have to go into effect, okay? So the exchanges can't deny you, right? Medicare, Medicaid cannot deny you. So right now, people with pre-existing conditions are living in this loophole if they've lost their coverage, hoping that the exchanges come online so that they can get access. They do not say, however, that you cannot charge somebody, for example, who you know is going to draw more from the system, more money a year than someone who is healthy. There are limits, however, to how much you can raise rates. So I did a scan, actually, of some insurance law, state by state, recently, and the max that you can raise rates year over year is 10% currently. That's post-healthcare reform. Prior to healthcare reform, open market. Each state would decide if a payer breached what would be a norm. So I don't know if any of you guys had healthcare coverage prior to the implementation of that law limiting year-over-year increases. I know my family saw our rates go up, I think 20-something percent, suddenly before that aspect of the law came down. Because insurance companies realized this is the last licks. We've got to get in increases before this part of the law gets implemented. So that is a scary part of the potential revising the law.
Just a follow-up question. That year-over-year thing, does that mean every year they can increase it 10%?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
When you're talking about that last 20% jump, is that something that opponents of the law kind of jumped on as evidence of its, you know, the fact that it wasn't working that we were seeing? Because that just sounds like, I mean, you know, you're almost baiting people who are against this bill by saying, you know, giving them something to point to that, look, you know, costs are up 20%.
So here's what's interesting. Both sides seized on those increases as justification for their point. you know, Democrats looked at it and said, now, my God, can you imagine if we didn't have this 10% cap coming in? And Republicans said, see, when the government gets involved and puts pressure on private industry, it throws the free market system out of balance. And technically, both were right. Right? Government interventions, in fact, was massive premium increases because companies said, I'm about to have my right of profit curtailed.
And so that factors in then to Romney's claim that the average American's health care premium increased by $2,400 or something over the last year. Did they make some similar claim like that in the debates?
2010 to present, yeah. If you look nationally, they did go up. Again, you would basically look at a graph, though, and say over time, they go up and then they stay flat. And the question is, what was the graph like to the left-hand side of the implementation?
Could you maybe give a general summary of the difference between Romney and Obama's plans, assuming that Romney has put forth a definitive plan? But just from what I've understood, from what I've heard him say...
Wait, have you voted yet? Because
I have voted, sorry.
Okay, well...
I think they're closed, so it doesn't matter now.
8 p.m.
8 p.m., okay. Well,
8 to 8.
Sorry if I'm influencing anybody, but from what I've read, it sounded like Romney wanted to keep everything essentially the same except for the individual mandate.
So, okay, that's a great question. September 19th, plus or minus a day, it was a Sunday, Romney gets on Meet the Press and turns around and on Meet the Press says something that about blew my socks off as I was about to go to a healthcare conference. He said, there are individual components of the healthcare reform law I agree with. Okay, so a couple of things that were just absolutely, what? One, he called it healthcare reform. Republicans do not call this healthcare reform. It is called Obamacare, or the job-killing, I hate free market economy law. Okay, it's not called healthcare reform. The only people who call it healthcare reform traditionally are Democrats. But then they got into this weird thing during the election where they decided to take back Obamacare. Like, I'm going to take a derisive term and I'm going to make it my own. I'm going to say, yeah, I love Obamacare. We did Obamacare. So interestingly enough, first time I ever heard Governor Romney say healthcare reform. Second thing was he used the words like in the same sentence as healthcare reform. Now, this should be pretty common sense because I have no idea, to be blunt, what Governor Romney's healthcare reform plan is, or his healthcare law. I know what Paul Ryan's ideas are around slashing Medicare spend, creating a voucher system where you're basically paying the elderly a certain stipend and then they get to go into the free market and purchase healthcare insurance. I don't know how many of you have elderly people in your family. I have some serious concerns about giving grandma or grandpa with dementia or Alzheimer's a check to go buy their own healthcare. You know, there are some very high concerns with Ryan's plan. Ryan's plan is as far to the right as I've seen. But Romney hasn't really put forward a point-by-point plan. But what can you look to? Action. My world, action speaks louder than words. As governor of Massachusetts, Romney put in a fantastic healthcare reform plan for that population. So my hope is, if Mitt's elected, he can back away from the fringe of his party. I got the seat. You're not going to kick me out in 4 years. I mean, let's face it, right? Once you're in, you're in. Your party can hate you. They're not going to bounce you out because they want the re-election. He can back away from all this rhetoric and instead of first stop repeal law, make it first stop gut law. Here's the reason why. If you turn around and you repeal the entire law, you then have to say piece by piece, what do you want to reenact? And that's gotta go into the House and it's gotta go into the Senate. And the Democrats are not gonna be in a mood to say, well, realistically, in the spirit of what we did, that was in there too, so of course we're gonna support you. It's gonna be full contact. So unless he has the House and the Senate by overwhelming majority, the idea of re-enabling piece by piece, we're gonna be in a world of hurt. However, if he just takes out the individual mandate or takes out, you know, in terms of expanding coverage, for example, the idea that if you expand coverage as an employer, you have to provide coverage for contraceptive services. I work with some of the largest Catholic health systems in the country. They are not jazzed about that. However, what they've said is, and these are Catholics, you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Yes, there are aspects of the law we don't agree with as providers of Catholic mission-based healthcare, but the alternative to throw it out is catastrophic. So my hope is, based on Massachusetts, a lot of this just stands. And we pluck away a couple of things, he gets to appeal to his base, and we're rocking and rolling. But the alternative, Ryan's plan, as a Canadian, I'll be FedExing my sixth self back up the 49th parallel.
Well, maybe our final question can be from Grace.
I was going to ask, you touched on this a little bit, talking about the opinion from Catholic hospitals, but as you interact with different people in the health industry, from insurance companies to just different aspects of healthcare providers, be it hospitals or doctor's offices, who's in favor, who's terrified, who's thinking that this is going to gut the system too much? Like, obviously, someone's going to lose out.
Really interesting question. So when healthcare reform passed, it was supported by the American Hospital Association, the American Medical Association. Yeah, it didn't get a lot of press, interestingly enough. They were pretty involved in Obama's 2008 campaign. They were dead silent this time. One of the reasons why they were dead silent is because they looked at this from the aggregate view of all doctors, all hospitals, all Americans, and said, you know what, things have got to change. This is in no way, shape, or form going to be the be-all and end-all. For example, it never addressed tort. Okay, tort is malpractice. Malpractice is a huge problem in the United States. It drives up cost, right? And physicians do not have a lot of protection. George W. Bush put caps on settlements. It's still ridiculous what physicians have to pay. As a side note, the neurosurgeons of the world, highest premiums. Second highest premiums, OBGYNs. Because the statute of limitation for suing your OBGYN is 18 years. You decide little Johnny should have been Mozart, Picasso, and you know John Elway all wrapped into one, you can go back on 17 and a half years later and say, I'm going to sue you because that cord was wrapped around that baby's neck, and I know he should have been 99th percentile and everything. So that law basically left a lot on the table. So what happened was, they basically said, we're going to go for it as institutions. And then their members said, what about us? As an aggregate, yeah, I was good. What about me? What about me as a doctor in Lincoln, Nebraska? What about me as a Christian conservative doctor in Lincoln, Nebraska? So what I've heard for 2 years across the United States is, we understand, A, things need to change. B, we understand that if you're not delivering high-quality, good care, you should not be getting paid the same as someone who's delivering poor care. People who are doing great should get more patients, and they should get paid more. Those who suck at delivering healthcare should probably get out of the business. But the other aspect was, how does that align with how I am not as a medical professional? That's what's scary for me personally. So my job right now is I work with boards of directors for non-for-profits. So boards are primarily made up of affluent people who are successful in their community. They tend to be Caucasian, they tend to be male, they tend to be over the age of 65. Guess what the predominant voting pattern of that group would be? I'm running stats right now, if you're CNN, Gallup, or Pew. Okay? Yet, they need to make decisions for an entire community, many of which do not look anything like them. This is where things get scary in America. Is can you put your personal politics aside and deliver your mission as a doctor, the CEO of a hospital, or the chair of a board? I have not seen in this election a lot of evidence that people are willing to compartmentalize their roles to do that effectively.
Thank you.